laws of nature that a person, when he's under the gun, you see, it's also the proof that it's animals are not under God's personal God's personal guidance. So therefore, I mean, there you see, it's natural that this system, certain animals, and definitely humans, when they're troubled, that forces them to think, and that helps them get out of being a downtrodden. And that's how he created in the laws of nature to help the downtrodden. He's not talking about animals in this pasuk. He's talking about humans. But I only gave the illustration of an animal to show you another area in which it works, so you could see it. That God is close to all that are downtrodden, and not all people can work this out. The answer is that when it says that God is close to all that are downtrodden, first of all, once you're talking in the laws of nature, you're only talking about probability. And the thing is that, yes, there are certain things that are in the laws of nature that could benefit you, but if you don't take advantage of it, then it's not going to benefit you. In other words, there's sometimes things that in the laws of nature that could benefit you, like this case here, like it is here that you can, there are situations that forces you to think. And there are some people that don't take that into consideration. They don't think that way. And they don't do it. So you're right, they don't take into consideration this thing. But in general, if you do watch the cycle of leadership and rulership throughout, you usually see that there are changes. Sometimes the changes are longer, sometimes less, sometimes it's dependent on there's a lot of factors. I'm not saying there aren't a lot of other factors in what causes changes. This is not the only factor. But I am saying that this is a factor for the downtrodden within the laws of nature to build themselves up and to get up in the world. That is the way that you can get up. But of course it's there, but I think you have to do something about it in this case. A person has to have a motive for thinking, okay? What we say that a person should strive for is that he should have the motive for thinking should be his love of learning and truth. That's the highest level. That's what we say the motive is. But however, in the outside world, the motive is usually practical. And because most people want to be successful, so therefore, if the only way they can be successful is by using the wisdom, so that's when they use their wisdom. You see? So the motivation is for success. It's like a level shema. Right? It's like a wrong motive for thinking. But however, we hope it should lead to the correct motive, meaning the love of learning. But however, when we say that necessity is the mother of invention, we mean that the emotions, there's an emotional drive because of either you need to get out of a problem or you need for success, you say, causes you to think. That's how it works. Well, I'm showing it in the laws of nature. I mean, definitely in God's personal intervention, God would definitely, these things would happen too. But the thing is, what I'm trying to say is we could see it all around us, how God relates to us and helps us in every possible way, even within the laws of nature. It's really there. You can really see how God supplies us. That's what this chapter is all about, how God supplies us with all our needs. Us and every creature that he created, he supplies them with all their needs. And I'm just trying to show you through the pasuk. David HaMelech, King David is trying to show you how it works, how it really works. The question is any difference between where a guy wants to make a buck and a guy wants to get closer to God? The answer is that insofar as thinking is concerned, a person has to think. In other words, in everyday life there's a certain type of strategy and thought, that there's a training of the mind. Now the only thing is the study of God is a different science. But that training of the mind, you could, like for instance, we train our mind in Talmud, right? I mean, then there's the subject of God, like we're doing now, which is a different science. You see? So the thing is, it's a different study. So the thing is but it gets, but it shows you. But this idea shows you that really the root of all success, the root of reaching God, the root of everything insofar as a human being is concerned, is his knowledge. That's the only way he's going to get any place. And you really see that success is in knowledge, and that should be the real security. And ultimately, through your knowledge, then you will see that your real security is in God. But it's via the knowledge that you have that security in God. You see? You got to be careful. I mean, there's certain people that their security is in thinking per se. I mean, that's also a danger. You know what I mean? But I'm saying that it's via thinking that you really reach God and see that the real security is in God, and how that security works is only through knowledge. Now, the same thing is that as you see that from the practical, from what we just said, when you see this idea that the only way of really knowing what's good for you, what's beneficial, and the only way of really being successful is through wisdom, so then that leads you into the world of wisdom and knowledge, into the world of learning. And when you see that the ultimate learning is the knowledge of God, the ultimate learning is the wisdom, and that's real, that's the ultimate success, then definitely going to put your energy into there. His strategy is only for money. And he never pulls out to realize that what made him successful was the knowledge. That even how he got the money was through knowledge. And anything else he wants is going to have to be through knowledge. If he doesn't pull out but he attaches to the money, that's the danger. Either at some point, either he trained himself to think this way in money so he won't fall by the wayside, but his child will, because he puts so much emphasis on the value of money, or he himself, it's possible that after a while he won't think, because he'll feel he has the security of money. But the real thing is that the ultimate would be is if he could pull out and suddenly realize, hey, what got me the money? That must be more powerful than the money. What will get me power? Oh, strategy, so that should be more powerful, so then let me think about life itself. You see? That's the ultimate. You see? This is why I think that God made it this way, so it's another way in which a person could find wisdom as a guide for life. And once you find wisdom as a guide for life, the odds are you will find God. You see? But simultaneously, the downtrodden are lifted up via this mechanism that they're forced to think. If they stay thinkers, then they'll never be downtrodden. There were certain thinkers that failed. It seems to be they failed, right? Like Rabbi Akiva, right? He was a thinker, right?
Yeah.
Somebody mentioned Socrates. Somebody mentioned Galileo. Okay? And these were the people that were really thinkers, right? And yet they seem to fail. Now we said that there are three ways that a person could fail. One is via himself, you see. One is via other people, and three via the laws of nature. Okay. Now, insofar as Rabbi Akiva is concerned, There had to have been a decree by God that Israel should be, so something even bad should happen to Israel, right? Now, because Rabbi Akiva is part of the nation of Israel, so therefore he's part of it, and therefore it's going to happen. He can't be separated. He gets it, so therefore it happens to him. He can't pull out. He can't beat that. Okay? And the same thing in the, okay, now insofar as Socrates and Galileo, so therefore, by them, there are certain situations. Well, Socrates, he got it because he decided to fight for justice, you see. He stood up for justice and he also stood up for justice, You see, I mean, that's the truth. Truth, I'm sorry. Stood up for truth, not justice. But the thing is that many times, yes, these things, sometimes there's a certain point where a person has to take a stand. Insofar as practically is concerned, they have to take a stand. They realize they're taking the stand, and that's it. But when we're talking about this pasuk, we're saying in general, let's face it, I mean, what we see that the downtrodden get up, I mean, this pasuk is a question altogether where you ask the question, where do you see people get up? Unless you're going to say it's God's personal intervention, and then it's only a person that's on a certain level that God helps them up. You see? But insofar as the laws of nature, I think this is the closest we could get to how it works. I understand there are a lot of other outside factors that will not allow it, or even the Chacham, what happened with Galileo and Socrates, they made a decision to stand by either justice or truth. And so therefore, it's a different type of situation. Their practicality, they realized the practicality would be problematical, but they traded the practicality for the truth. But here we're talking about people that are naturally, they're not thinkers, they're downtrodden, they're broken, you see? And therefore, within the laws of nature, it becomes a way of getting out of it. That a person that thinks that necessity is the mother of invention, we're not saying that person is on a high level of relationship to God. We're not saying that. He's not in any relationship to God. Relationship to God only comes from your knowledge of God. That's a separate thing. But he's talking about people being downtrodden, so therefore we're talking about all people. Within the laws of nature, a person that is trained to be a thinker can pull out. There's not other outside, you know what I mean? There's a lot of outside factors that will stop him. But I'm talking about insofar as himself is concerned, he can't pull out. What I'm saying is that God is God raises them. It doesn't mean that God comes down and pulls them up. But he puts them within the laws of nature, created that they could pull themselves out. That's what it means. That they have the ability, unless the circumstances that's out of your grasp, that you can't help yourself. But if it's not circumstances out of your grasp, so then you have the ability to pull yourself out. That's what it means. God is close to them. And you give to them their food in their time. Proper time. This is that the eyes of all, we're talking about, according to the Radak, we're talking about all types of animals and humans. That every the first part is the eyes of you look expect the eyes of all look expectantly to you is talking about that they have certain needs, because every species has different needs. Certain species eat grass, certain species eat seeds, certain species eat other animals. You see, they all have different needs. And so therefore, God, they all look to God for their, it doesn't mean that they particularly look. I mean, they don't know, again. But it means is that it's only via God that this one, or the human being recognizes that they turn to you, that they need, because they need these things. And not only do you give it to them, but each one of them has their time when they eat. Some eat, only go hunting by night, some by day. Some store away for the winter, some all different times. Their natural times when they eat or when they get their food happens at different seasons, and so therefore he makes sure that each one gets it at their correct time. Right? The animals don't look towards God, but however we recognize the system that God satisfies all their needs at all times. In their correct times. What it means is that the animal is deficient without the rest of the system of the universe working to help him get it. In other words, the animal by itself needs, let's say, needs certain, let's say, for instance, squirrel. He needs nuts during the spring, with summer, and then he during the winter. So he has to have enough to put it away for the winter, right? So, right? That's what we say, squirrels it away, right? Okay, so the system has to work. That he should be able to have enough of his nuts during the winter and be able to put it away so that it not only we have for the summer, we'll have it for the whole winter. You see? So therefore, he is deficient. He's not self-sufficient. The animal is not self-sufficient, but however the whole system works so that each, I mean, the whole system, the whole natural laws work so that each species get exactly what they need for the survival of that species. Is that sometimes, like for instance, like we see that by Mount St. Helens, when it blew, it destroyed the whole forest, and yet we see that the forest is now starting to grow back, and the animals are starting to come back, and flowers are, and it's a whole ecological system. Sometimes there is a breakdown in the system, and yet it's created, that God created within the world, that somehow the planet could replenish itself and work itself out in a different fashion, and somehow a different way to fit in with the ecological system. Even that, you have to say, as part of this, that we look to God to help us out in those situations where there are changes. Sometimes the changes are made by humans. Sometimes, you see, it works out. Sometimes the humans change things too fast, and the earth doesn't have time to gain, to change, to recoup in a way that would be satisfactory to all. Okay? But however, in general, you usually do see wherever there's damage done, that the planet does have a certain, if it's given a certain amount of time, it will recoup its losses and work things out. This, I say, is also part of this pasuk. God created this as a part of the laws of nature, and God, that's how you see God's wisdom. When you see how God created the laws of nature in such a perfect system, and that it has a means of recouping its losses, and either because of a volcano or either because of human negligence, so you see that God created that it can recoup. You see God's wisdom and how he created the very laws of nature, and that's what it means, that everybody turns to God for their needs. And you give them in their time, and you work it out, that everything should work out. And if there is a problem, so then somehow things work out again. What it means is that they look to you with hope. It means is that the human being recognizes that every being is deficient in themselves. And they need something outside of themselves. So only the human recognizes this when he looks at the system, and the system is created such that it satisfies every species all its needs, that they will be satisfied. The species as a whole will be satisfied within the laws of nature. That's how God created the laws of nature. You open your hand and satisfy every living being his according to his desires. By desires means his needs. His will, what he wills. What he wills over here, with so it means his needs. That's what he wills. It does not mean the fantasy of a human being. No, it does not include the fantasy of a human being. That will not be, that can't be satisfied anyway. So therefore it cannot mean that. Real needs that a person needs in the physical world. The question is what does it mean he opens his hands? God doesn't have hands, so therefore it must be some type of metaphor, speaking about God, okay? Now, what the class wants to say is basically that he opens his hands means that it's available
for anybody to take what they need according to their needs. It's available, but people have to, not only people, but animals, have to go actively and take it and get it, but it's always there for whatever they need. It is always there. Problem, because the human being desires much beyond what his needs are, like greed and jealousy and competition. People go for a tremendous amount of things beyond which they really need. We're not talking about these types of fantasies. We're talking about needs, a real need that a person, well, the animals, they don't have this, so they just go for their needs. But by the human, it's slightly different, that they have fantasies that are way beyond their needs. And so therefore, he's not talking about satisfying that's for sure, because that's not what we mean by his needs. What he needs, I mean, that we spoke about in detail, and we'll speak about it more, what a human being's needs are, but to distinguish between that, his real needs, and his fantasy, which he does not need, or which he should try to undo. Try to deal with that and try to undo that. An illustration, okay? Right. During the Second World War, okay, we had a third of the people, approximately, that was in the war, fighting. They had another third of people working to send supplies to these people. So there was only a third working for all the needs of the physical needs of the people, right? So one person said that after the war, if everybody worked around three, four hours a day, that would be enough to supply everybody. So apparently we'd have a great life, right? According to that, so you want to make a little more, so we'll work 5 hours a day. Fine. You know what I mean? Well, a few luxuries. Okay, so you work 5 hours a day. But the thing is that if everybody, but what happened was, is the greed and the competition came in, and people were working 15 hours a day to beat out their competitor. It wasn't just a matter of fulfilling your need, but it was a matter of beating somebody, or greed, or whatever the emotion is. There are many different emotions. So the thing is that you see there's really enough for everybody. Verse 17, God is righteous in all his ways, and he is gracious in all his works. Now we have to ask is, what does he mean he is just? Also just, God is just, righteous, just. He does the right thing with a just thing. So, okay? I mean, the word, the God is just, the tzaddik, is that it means that simply that he every being that he created that it can satisfy all its needs. Like we said before, that God satisfies its needs. That was Chanun, and then Rachum is mercy, means that he gives it the ability to remove all harm that occurs to this type of being, so that the species sort of exists. So the thing is that is a just creator. It would be unjust for him to create a being that cannot be satisfied. But God creates a being, and he creates the ability for him to be satisfied in every situation, in all ways, and also to be able to protect himself from any type of harm. That is just. It's just a summary of what we've been saying up until now. Is that sometimes you find there are people that have neuroses and psychoses that they can't be satisfied. Okay? The answer is that in general, this is a problem that's a separate problem that's way beyond what we're dealing with. This is a question that deals with all the problems of God justice. But basically you find most of the problems that occur for the human being in particular is because God wanted free will. There should be one species that has free will, and since we have a choice to make between living in reality and not living in reality, that's how all these problems occur. These two systems coming together, the reality plus the system that was created to us to see the world in an incorrect way, like jealousy and all these type of things. So therefore, there became many, many problems. realize that you have to understand God's system, understand how it works within the laws of nature, then there are many, many questions. I understand many questions are going to open up now. In other words, it's always the way that as your mind opens to new areas, the questions become tremendously more. You know what I mean? It usually opens up more questions. Even though it's clearer now, but then new questions are open. But we can't cover all the questions. I mean, I'd rather stay in the content. I mean, then we'd have 20 tapes, and it's really not dealing with the subject. You know what I mean? I'd really prefer sticking to the subject. But just to answer in general, that God's plan was that one species should have free will. And I think most of the problems in the world come from that. But that's God's plan, that he wanted free will. Of that desire.
Right. The result
of God's will, that God's will was to have free will, right, that people should have free will, therefore we have all these problems. Now, when it says God is gracious, right, in all his works, right, now, what is gracious? I mean, if he does exactly what the human being needs, so what all species needs, right? So then the question is, so what can he do more? Where did he do more? What's the more? Question, the word possible answer, somebody wants to answer, is that he gave us the Torah. That was gracious. That was more. The answer is he had to give us Torah because since we have free will, he has to give us a guide to help us out. We need a guide to help us out. How many people are going to make it without Torah? How many Abrahams are there that he worked it out from the physical world in itself? Never make it without wisdom. You can't. You must have a guide. Because since we have the evil inclination, which was the other side of free choice, right? And the only thing that could overcome that is the knowledge of Torah. You see? Like Satyagraha says, what is evil? Evil is ignorance. If you knew clearly the truth about a certain thing, if it's really clear in your mind, then it's impossible not to do. So therefore, the only reason why you could do evil is because you're lacking this knowledge. So it's a result of ignorance. So therefore, you have to have a study. Now, therefore, the Torah gave us a means in which it is true, there was an Abraham that found it on his own. But that's not the species. The species is not, in general, is not going to make it in finding it out from the physical world through a study of the physical world. How many people do you find? We have a whole nation, or anybody else that wants to learn this knowledge, can have this knowledge through the study of Torah. That's not gracious. It's like a need. It's part of our needs to have this knowledge, or now we wouldn't make it. The world can't make it without it. Would any of us have this knowledge if we didn't have Torah? I mean, would any of us have sat down just to study the law? There would be nothing. We wouldn't be getting it. How many people would get it? Which, insofar as Torah is concerned, there's halacha, which that you can't get. I mean, God wanted a halachic system. That definitely is a need. I mean, that God wanted. That was part of God's plan. Even if you're going to say it's not a need, then it's definitely, halacha is definitely a part of God's plan. That's definitely. And the other part, Satyagraha says that why was the other parts of Torah written since a person could get it from the laws of nature? He says it's simply that a person could get it at an earlier age. He gets it faster. You understand? So that he has it. Like, for instance, we have kids in high school that have knowledge, that live a good life, that's starting on a good direction because they have the knowledge of Torah. But if you had to start from first principles and start building up, nobody would have a real philosophy until they were 40 or 50. Very few people. There are two answers. There's the Radak's approach and the Ibn Ezra's approach to this problem. Okay? The Radak says that there are things which really a human being does not need. If, for instance, there's halacha, that when you make a party for aniyim, you know, like you have four people, and you set up for them, you should set up more than their needs. Should be left over. Why? Because the thing is that there's a certain psychological need that a person feels, like, in other words, if you have your needs, but there's a certain security, like I have more, you have more, there's a certain, there's a halacha like that, there's a certain security, right? Like, for instance, a person has enough what to live on, right? But the thing is, if he has a little more, there's a certain security, which he really doesn't need. There's a little more in everything around us that certain satisfaction that we have that, like, for instance, let's say, for instance, you need a vacation, right? Person needs a vacation. That's a need. That you can work a certain amount, then you need a vacation. You can take a vacation by, you know, staying around the house, going for walks, you know, just not working, right? But however, there's, like, you go out into the nature, which you don't get a chance. You enjoy nature, which is so beautiful, which is beyond, you know what I mean? It's really not a need, but it's a satisfaction. There is a thing, in other words, there are things that are just there for your satisfaction, that you, it satisfies you, but it's not a need. You could live without it. You know what I mean? You could live in a house that's a hovel, like, you know what I mean? But then you have a person that has more, you know what I mean? There's a certain feeling of satisfaction that you have, even though you don't have the, even though you don't have the need for it. You can satisfy the need other ways. It's a totally different approach. He says, chosed b'chol mas, he says, tzaddik, that he's righteous, that God is righteous, that's the actions that God does for us. It's the actions. God does certain actions. That is just, like we explained before. Chosed is the way he does it. That there is no personal gain. He's just doing it only for the need. There's no personal gain. God doesn't gain anything. There's no gain from this. In fact, we don't know why he did it altogether. That's a question that King David asked. He says that he doesn't understand why God created us altogether. But the fact that he did create us, and the fact that he gives us all our things, is there is absolutely no benefit to him. Absolutely no benefit. That's what it means he's gracious. When he does his righteousness, the motive is nothing personal. There's no personal motive. There's no personal gain with why God is doing it. Isn't it obvious that God has no motive and no benefit? The truth is that when you look around, for a lot of people, when they relate to God, they relate in a sort of the way they act. I'm not talking about in their mind, but you see that it's there someplace, that they, it's some type of a trade, like, I'll pray to you, and you could do me good things. So if you do me good things, then I'll pray, then I'll do your commandments, and listen to you, you know? So it's some type of trade. You see, it's not that clear that God's motives are totally, that you can't do anything for God, and there's no benefit, that God could benefit in any way from these things. The question is why, how do we know that we cannot know that God, why God created the world? In other words, what's the proof that we cannot know that why God created the world? The answer is very simple. Since we cannot know anything about God and what his motives are, what guides him, I mean, all these terms that I'm using now, motive and guide, you can't even apply to God, you see, because we do not know anything about God. And since the answer to this question must necessitates a knowledge of God, so therefore it's an impossibility to know why God created the world. All we can know is that since he created it, that he does it in a just way, and that when he's gracious, he has no benefit at all. That's exactly what we're saying. There is no benefit for him at all. But however, when he does it in a just way. That we do know. But why he created it, that you would have to know God, which is impossible for a human being to know.
based on what God, how God relates to us. This has to be based on the knowledge of God, of why God creates. You say, yes, all I know is God creates. The fact that the physical world is here, you see that he creates, and the Torah says that he created. So we know that God creates. But why he creates, that you have to know God. Possible. You say that God is righteous, and God is a chassid. We're not saying a quality about God. We don't know God. We're saying how he relates to us. How he relates to us. One way he relates to us is tzaddik, righteous, which means that he gives, satisfies all our needs. And then chassid was saying that there is no gain, since God is not physical, I mean, whatever that means, it's not a clear thing, but there's no gain. God cannot gain anything from anything a physical thing does. I mean, no benefit. Okay? What I want to say is that where it says that God is righteous in all his ways, and that God is righteous in all his actions, the verse shows, the verse is pointing to the fact that these are just actions of God and not who God is. In other words, the verse itself is pointing this idea out. That's very good. That God is close to all that call upon him, and to all who call upon him in truth. It says God is close to all that call to him, is telling us that anybody that calls to him, meaning from any nation, any human being that calls out to him, God is close to that person. Okay? That's the first half. Second half is that, but this calling must be in truth. In other words, there are certain people that pray, like when they pray, they know all the words, but it has no real meaning to them. You ask them what it means, like they don't know what it means. So what it means in truth is that it must be a truth to you. It must be real. Not that you say it's truth. But even then, a lot of people say, I take it as a truth that this is, you know, I take a fact that this is true. But how do you know it's true? Do you really know it's true? Or do you just feel it's true? It must be true. True means you know. It's a knowledge that you really know that it is true. So therefore, when you really actually say your words, whatever prayer it is, it must be real to you, then God is close to you. The half of the verse is defining the nature of what we mean by calling. The first half of the verse, it's saying, is there anybody excluded from this? No, every human being is included in this. Now, what is the condition that God, what is called calling? What is the definition of calling? When you call unto God, right? When you call out unto God, right? What does that mean, call? So therefore, the Radak says it must be in truth, which means that you must know within you what you are saying. When you're calling out, it must be a true idea, not just some vague feeling, and you don't know what you're really saying. Just saying, who can God be close to? God be close to any human being that calls to him. Now, what is the definition of calling? What is the definition of calling? I have to know what calling means. They say, hey God, is that enough? Or is there certain conditions in the call? The only condition in the call is that it must be in truth. By truth means that you truly understand what you are saying. Then God could be close to you. What does it mean that God is close to you? Okay, that's the question. The answer is that there are two ways in which God relates to you. One way that God relates to you is through the laws of nature. In other words, he created the laws of nature so that you should relate to the laws, through the laws of nature you relate to God. But however, there's another level of relating to God, and that is God's personal relationship to us. The best way to define the difference between the two is that the laws of nature don't know you. In other words, if you go into a tide and the tide pulls you out, so you don't the tide doesn't know you. Or if a tiger eats you, it's not, don't take it personally. Okay? All right. But however, in the laws of nature, and when God's personal relationship to you, there the laws of nature operate based on your soul. And therefore, the laws of nature can, in other words, can be redirected based on your soul. In other words, according to the laws of nature, let's say something should happen to you, right? So the laws of God can cause, there is a system where the laws of nature change somehow based on your soul, okay? This is that at this point in Ashrei, there is a change. Up until here, we were watching we were relating to God. It was showing us in the relationship of the human to God is that God related to us through the laws of nature, and we're showing how the laws of nature itself is a just and righteous system. That's what we ended up. It is a just and righteous system, and that God created the whole system, and as you start seeing it, you will see that that's exactly the way it is. Okay? But however, now the question is, there is even a better way of relating to God, where if you're in some type of trouble, which we'll get into in the next verse already, but however, let's put it this way, you can call to God, and God will listen to you, meaning that via, in other words, when you have knowledge of God, like the Radak says, it's not just verbally repeating the prayers, but truly understanding what the prayers there are, that brings you closer to God so that God could relate to you. That knowledge, the knowledge is one step in the development, and then the prayers where you go over it and it becomes second nature to you and your emotions come in line with these ideas, then that's another level. Now each level brings you closer to God, and the closer you get to God, then the closer that God could get to you. There's a direct ratio between God's between your knowledge of God and God's personal relationship to you. Now, verse 19. Fear, he fulfills the will of those that fear him, and those that scream unto him, he hears their cries. And their screams he hears, and he saves them. The will of those that fear him, and that they scream, that they yell to him, is there are two types of situations. Sometimes a person simply under the laws of nature has certain problems, so therefore he could pray to God. In other words, the ray of the ones that fear him are those that are calling unto him. This is a continuation of the last verse. And those are the ones, these are the ones that call unto him. And there are two situations that they could call. One is that the laws of nature, that they're in trouble because the laws of nature sometimes don't always work in, perfectly. And sometimes it's because in the particulars, certain particular cases, it doesn't work exact. Something goes wrong. And two is because you've sinned, and therefore you're getting a punishment. So therefore you're calling unto God. It's all that love him, and he destroys, and all the wicked he destroys. So what's the difference between a person that fears God and a person that loves God? What's the difference in the nature of the two, and what's the difference in the way God relates to them? All right. The answer to the question that how God relates to us, the difference between those that fear him and those that love him. To those that fear him, a person that fears him, he can't have troubles in this world. And then that's why he has to call out to God.
He has to call out to God, and there's God to help him not to cause these problems. Okay? But however, the people that love him, it means that they do that God relates to them that these things never happen to them. God relates to them and these things don't happen to them. So since it doesn't happen, then they don't have to call out. And the question still is, what is the difference between those that love him and those that fear him?
Is the Midrash which states that Abraham wanted to related to God, and Nimrod, who was the king at the time, said that you should retract or not I'm going to kill you. So Nimrod built a big fire, and Abraham refused to give in to his desires. And but meanwhile, there was also Abraham's brother. Now, Abraham's brother was standing on the sideline, and he made a decision basically like this. He says that if Abraham lives through it, so there is a God, so then I'll go in and then I'll stick by your God, right? But if I see that he dies, so then I won't stick by God, okay? So then I'll give in to Nimrod, okay? Now, so the thing is that, and we know that Nachor, according to the Medrash, he saw that that Abraham was saved. So he said that he's going to stick by God, and he was thrown into fire and he died. So the Ramban asked the question, why? Why did Nachor die? The answer is that Abraham, when he accepted God, period. No matter what happens, even if something bad happens, he accepted God. You see? But other people have a relationship with God, and it is a relationship that they relate to God, but they also need the rewards and the results of the what God promises. Like in the Torah, God promises, they need that result, they do it for that result. So that's a Yireyav. That's a person that relates to God, via fear, right? In other words, he fears God because he fears the punishments and he fears the consequences of his actions. So therefore, he turns to God for help. You see? However, the person that loves God. In other words, that's a person that totally accepts God unconditionally. It doesn't make a difference. I mean, whatever happens, he'll try to work it out to the best that he can, but it will never affect his relationship to God. If God helps him or not helps him, he does not question God. He only tries to understand why God operates in different ways. That's all he cares. If God helps him, so he wants to understand why God helps him in this situation. If God doesn't help him, he might try to understand why God doesn't help him, if he can. But his love, his relationship to God is unconditional. That's love of God. Fear of God is where you need certain results. Now, the thing is that since when you fear, God will not undo it, so therefore you call unto God. When you call unto God, that is prayer. In other words, prayer is a certain level of knowledge of relating to God and to express your feelings, and it lifts. In other words, through the ideas of tefillah, by going over, even though you have the knowledge, this knowledge, but your emotions are not in line with it. See, by Nachar, it seemed to have been a conscious thing altogether. By the brother of Abraham, he was endowed consciously. You see? By the people that fear him consciously, they do have the true knowledge of God. And they know that they should give God unconditional love. But however, their emotions are not in line with that yet. Their emotions are not in line. That's what the people that fear him. So therefore, the prayer is supposed to help their emotions by going over the ideas again and again. It's supposed to help their emotions be in line with these ideas. So therefore, when you pray and you go over and your emotions make a step closer to God, so then God could help you.
But if you reach the level where even emotionally you have unconditional relationship to God, And therefore, no matter what happens, so then that's a person that these things won't even happen to. God will protect them automatically. Three levels. There is the level of Nochar where he has a question logically. He's not sure. That's right. He's not even sure. He's still working it out. He's waiting practically. He's working out the whole. He's not working it out even philosophically or thought out, like he's not studying Torah. It's just that he's seeing it practically. If it works, it's just a practical thing. That's one level. Then there's the Yireyev, which have a knowledge of God, have a knowledge of God, but their emotions are not in line with it yet. They still relate to God that they're still afraid of the fear and the punishments and all the things that could happen to them emotionally. So they need prayer, because that prayer is for the purpose of getting their emotions in line with God. But however, the lovers of God, those that love God, meaning that their emotions are in line with it, you see? So those people won't even have to pray to God. God won't even let the situation occur. And insofar as God and all the wicked he'll destroy, there are two possibilities. One is, insofar as the laws of nature is concerned, there's really three possibilities. One possibility is, insofar as the laws of nature is concerned, most wicked people get the consequences of their actions. Okay, practically all, 99%. Insofar as the laws of nature is concerned. If God wants to destroy the wicked because how it affects Israel, or how it affects the righteous, so then because of the righteous, God himself will go out and destroy the wicked. Now you see many times in Torah that God destroyed the wicked insofar as the relationship to Israel, right? Or certain righteous people, he destroyed them insofar as certain righteous people. But otherwise, God doesn't bother destroying them because they'll just be destroyed by themselves. But if it's going to affect the righteous, so because of God's personal relationship to the righteous, so God has to relate to the wicked and destroy them. Okay? The third possibility is that there is no existence for them anymore. They're totally destroyed. After they die, there's no more existence. It's all over. Three fit into the pasuk. I'm just saying there's three ways that the Russia is destroyed. One is in the laws of nature that he suffers the consequences of his actions. Two, insofar as this is God's personal relationship to the righteous or to Israel, so therefore he'll have to destroy certain wicked people. And the third thing is that day after death there's no existence. Their existence is gone. So therefore it's all over. They have no more existence after death. 41. Praise of God is my mouth will speak, which will bless his name forever and ever. I think this is just a summary at the very end. Yadavapi, that my mouth speaks, that's King David. So it's just, he started with the Hilal of David, and he adds that David is going to praise, right? And then he adds, the praise of God as my mouth speaks. So therefore, all the praise that he said throughout this chapter, he speaks, right? And then all flesh will bless God, meaning their existence will show the truth about God. Their very existence will show to the human their existence of God.